Okay. And we're doing an informational meeting, which is an overview of the rail system. And I have a list of presenters, and if there's anyone that's not called up that wants to talk, we'll give them the opportunity. So the first panel will be Chris Peterson with Union Pacific, Bruce Carswell with Portland and Western, and Jonathan Hutchinson with Amtrak.
Madam Chair, can you take a moment to welcome Representative Burley, who's seen in with
thank
us today.
You.
It's great to see his smiling face come across the...
Well, thank you. It's great to be back with transportation.
Well, it's good to have you back. So, the rest, Bruce and Jonathan, can both come up?
They might be afraid of Representative Burley, though.
Oh, okay.
Intimidation.
Well, since we have someone, it looks like he's all set up and ready to go. Why don't you introduce yourself and where you're from and get started.
Great. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Peterson. I'm Director of Government Affairs for Union Pacific Railroad, based in Omaha, Nebraska, and glad to be here in Oregon today where it's much warmer than Nebraska. I have a slideshow that you all should have printed copies of, and so you'll be able to follow along, especially if you're not able to see the screen. And I'll try to move through the slides quickly and cover the issues that hopefully help to address some of the questions or some of the issues that you're looking to cover in today's hearing. The Union Pacific is based in 23 western states west of the Mississippi, and we have a network that is made up of many railroads that merged or consolidated, came together over the last 25 years or so, especially following the passage of the Staggers Act in 1980, which helped to deregulate, I should say, the railroad industry, and really brought us the modern, vibrant rail industry that exists today. As you can see with this graphic, we have about 32,000 miles of track, about $15 billion in revenue in 2006. We have 48,000 employees, more than 2,000 employees here in Oregon, 25,000 customers, all in varying sizes, and our capital spending program, which I'll talk a little bit more in detail about at the end of this slide presentation, is $2.8 billion in 2006, and we run about 2,700 trains a day across the network, and so it's a massive operation. The trains are dispatched primarily out of a facility in Omaha. We do have a couple of satellite dispatching facilities, but it's a robust network, very technology driven.
And Chair.
Yes.
Just one quick question. Chris, when you talk about miles of track, I know what lane miles are when we're talking about automobiles. Miles of track, if you've got two sets of track side by side, is that 1 mile or is that 2 miles?
That's a great question. Let me ask.
It counts twice. And it's the number of miles we have.
Okay, thank you. So
it's not
it's
a question
like a lane
I've
mile
before.
In effect.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you. You can see here is our commodity mix and industrial products, which includes lumber, paper products, also cement, steel, other raw materials such as that is our leading commodity in terms of revenue, followed closely by the intermodal category, which, of course, the containers of come in through the ports, and also other truck, train, transfer traffic. And energy, which is our coal business. Those are the major commodity groups that make up our revenue, ag products, automotive, chemicals being the other three. can see from this slide, this really recaps the highlights of our franchise, something that we're very proud of at Union Pacific, as we do have a diverse franchise. Whether it's the Pacific Northwest and forest products, agriculture from the Midwest, the Powder River Basin, coal, also coal in Colorado and Utah. We interchange at all the eastern gateways at Chicago and St. Louis, Memphis, New Orleans, and exchange in Kansas City with the eastern railroads to be able to serve customers across the country. We have a very strong chemical franchise, a great number of refineries on a great mix of chemicals in the Houston area, and that's a key component of our business. And we are the only railroad that serves all six gateways with Mexico, all six rail gateways with Mexico. And you can see they're identified on here as well. And, of course, we also serve one gateway at the border with Canada at Eastport, Idaho, which is an important driver for our business in Oregon. And then, of course, our service at the other West Coast ports outside the PNW, Oakland, Long Beach, and L.A., which bring us a significant amount of business. This map shows our line density the amount of freight traffic that we're carrying on our various lines. You can see here in the PNW, our most heavily traveled line extends eastward from Portland, and as business comes in from the ports of Portland and Seattle and is carried east across the country, that is a very heavily traveled line, and I'll get to another graphic here that shows the double track that we have and even triple track in our network. You can see that across Nebraska, as we bring coal out of the Powder River Basin, that is our most densely traveled line. The train traffic in central Nebraska reaches as many as 120 a day or more in some locations. If you lived at Gibbon, Nebraska, right smack dab in the middle of the state, you could count 120 trains a day passing by. And so this gives you a sense of again, our network and how it fills up with trains on a daily basis. You also notice the sunset route from Los Angeles to El Paso gives us a strategic advantage. It's the fastest route across the southwest out of Los Angeles and, again, taking those goods from the ports eastward. And here, as I mentioned, is the map that shows where we have double track and even triple track. The red lines represent single track railroad, and the gray represents double track. Double track allows us to be a lot more efficient, move more goods, and double tracking of the railroad not only allows us to double the amount of trains that could pass through that segment of railroad, but it's really much more than that. If you think about trains moving the same direction and a faster train being able to move past a slower train while both are moving at the same time, and so it really allows for some dynamic dispatching, so you can get much more than double the efficiency out of your network. Again, in central Nebraska, triple track. In across the southwest, double track, and a fair amount of the network from Portland east towards Salt Lake City is double tracked. This graphic shows our major yards across our network. Portland and Eugene here in Oregon are our major classification yards, and at Hinkle we have a hump yard where literally in the middle of the yard there is a hump. Old style humps are as much as 20 feet tall, where the train is where a train of cars is backed across the hump, and one at a time the cars come down the other side of the hump and into a spider web network of a yard where we build trains that then depart the yard for various destinations. And so modern hump yards actually have 6-foot high humps with a greater ability with modern engineering to control the speed of those cars as we build trains across those parallel tracks. And so this really reinforces the fact that for Union Pacific Railroad, Oregon is absolutely a key component of our rail network as goods are coming east and west because of the Hinkle Yard there in the Hermiston area, and our major yards in Portland and Eugene. Oregon is an absolutely key component to Union Pacific's rail network. This chart then shows the intermodal terminals, and intermodal, of course, meaning containers, and also, again, truck to train or train to truck transfer facilities, which have the opportunity to more economically move goods, especially long-haul goods, across the country or from point to point. And you can see that here in Oregon, we have facilities in the Portland area. Our on-dock facility at the Port of Portland allows us to move goods directly onto trains at the port. We have a terrific relationship with the Port of Portland, probably among, if not the best, certainly among the best relationships that Union Pacific has with any port. And it's a great partnership that benefits Oregon, benefits the port, benefits Union Pacific. This slide briefly recaps our passenger service relationships. We do have intercity commuter rail on our lines at Chicago, Dallas, Fort Worth, Oakland, Sacramento, and L.A. And we have Amtrak running across some of our main lines. Of course, here in Oregon, you're very familiar with Amtrak service on the I-5 corridor on our main line. But elsewhere, we also have Amtrak on our lines. This slide recaps again, looking specifically at the PNW, Oregon and Washington, on the density of traffic, the gross tons, and the red line extending east from Portland. Again, is our most densely traveled line in terms of gross tons per mile. This is a really interesting slide, and I'm not going to walk through every piece of it, but it's well worth your time to come back and look at it again after the hearing. It really demonstrates the partnerships that Union Pacific has, not just with Amtrak on our line, but the partnerships on the major main lines in the PNW, where short lines will operate on Union Pacific line, where BNSF will operate on Union Pacific line, and vice versa, where Union Pacific will operate on BNSF lines. And there really is a dynamic partnership in the PNW between the various freight interests and also passenger interests to work together to efficiently and safely move freight and passengers through the region. This slide summarizes the freight moving in and out of the state and where that freight is coming from or moving to. Shows what many would think is probably pretty obvious, that a fair amount of trade is taking place on the West Coast in and out of Oregon, but certainly nearly half of goods flowing in and out of Oregon are flowing into the middle part of the country. And so Oregon certainly in terms of the rail business is a dynamic player, not just in the West Coast but across the nation in terms of those inbound and outbound flows. And this slide drills down to goods specifically coming out of Oregon, and you can see again with the vast majority of forest products that flow out of Oregon, raw materials of that sort, it only makes sense that they'd be consumed within marketplaces, California, Arizona, Nevada, rather rapidly before they have a chance to find customers elsewhere. And so with the great demand for those goods, we're able to meet that demand and move those products from shippers in Oregon to nearby receivers. The lumber business in particular, close to the hearts of Oregonians, and again, you can see that a large share, 56% of lumber moving out of Oregon is being delivered into and for practical purposes consumed in the far west. Again, high growth markets, Phoenix, Las Vegas, Los Angeles, has a strong demand for those consumable raw materials. And then this takes us the other direction and shows inbound goods. Certainly, coal flowing in from the Powder River Basin from Colorado, Utah mines. Bulk goods coming into the Port of Portland. Among those would be grain coming out of the Dakotas, actually being carried out of the Dakotas by the Canadian Pacific, and then brought to Eastport, Idaho, where the Canadian Pacific interchanges with UP, and we bring those goods down to the Port of Portland. This recaps gets into a little bit more detail on those bulk goods. Again, the goods that go up through Canada and come back into the States, and you can see soda ash coming out of Wyoming to the Port of Portland, and the port is a real driver and draw for those goods to come here, and benefits the region through jobs and investment at the port. Total tons moving through the state, 20 million a year. And as we wrap up the slides here, this slide here recaps potential capacity issues in the PNW. This is important because as we think of Oregon, there really is connectivity to Washington State because of the interchange point at Eastport, Idaho. We have to have a robust line through Idaho into Spokane and down to the Hinkle Yard at Hermiston and when you finally hit Oregon. And so if we don't have a robust, efficient, safe rail network in Washington State, that's not good for Oregon. And so we monitor closely, obviously, what are capacity issues, where we see bottlenecks, where maintenance needs to be focused to make sure that that we're moving goods efficiently, safely. And here on this slide, it recaps a number of projects that are on the board that are being considered either by UP or by our partners or by our competitor, BNSF, where, again, we have a lot of terrific partnerships in the PNW. And over time, as we work to address these issues, either as individual railroads or together or through public partnerships, that will benefit the region and allow us to add additional freight to our capacity, to our main lines, and that'll help drive growth and jobs and investment in the region. And that brings me to the last slide, which underscores the investment that Union Pacific has made in Oregon the last 5 years. You can see since 2002, UP has put $250 million in capital into the state of Oregon. That includes maintenance, which is a critical activity, again, to maintain safe and efficient rail lines, but also our yards. But it does include, as well, capacity, safety issues, and the addition of locomotives. It's important to have enough power to be able to move those goods. And so it's a terrific figure. We're proud to share that with you today. And we do have budgeted in 2007 $65 million of capital investment in the state of Oregon. And we're going to continue to maintain our existing lines, add capacity where it's prudent, as long as we continue to be able to have a return on our investment. We're going to make those investments, and that'll help UP to grow. It'll help Oregon to grow. And so that recaps a brief presentation on UP and Oregon. If there's an opportunity to answer questions, I'd be happy to do that. My cohort here is Jim Nave, who's based in Vancouver, Washington, and works the Pacific Northwest for our marketing group. And he knows a little bit more specifically about the region. And so if we do get to questions, I may call on him to help out.
Thank you. Questions? Well,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, Chris, of the investments that you're making in Oregon right now, about 2002 through 2006 and 7, is any of that for this expanded trackage, the additional lane miles of tracks, so that you'll have the double capacity? Too frequently I see trains parked waiting for other trains coming up and down the gorge, and that's why I asked that question.
Mm-hmm. The gorge is unique, a bit of a challenge to add capacity in the gorge, and I can't speak today specifically to two projects, but as I looked over the numbers, I did have them broken down as I put this slide together, and there definitely were projects that involved adding sidings, which will improve the fluidity of our network, reduce the stop trains, and I know we've put a significant amount of capital again into the corridor from Eastport, Idaho to Hinkle Yard in recent years. We've also invested a significant amount of money specifically on the I-5 corridor. I do have another slide which I may be able to find after the hearing that details those capital improvements. I could share that with you.
Thank you. Just one follow-up, if I may. Chris, and you don't have to give me an answer today, but if I know that there are multiple company issues from the various companies, and you indicated the partnerships that you've got with the other side-by-side carriers or folks that cross over, if a total trip for a particular train, and let's go back and pick up some coal now, and let's bring it out to Oregon, and let's bring that coal, let's say, to the power plant in was it Sherman County? Is that where it's at? The coal fire plant.
Boardman.
Yeah, okay. Boardman. Let's bring that coal as far as you bring it, and then I understand that there's a couple of companies involved. Let's assume there's 400 miles in that process, and you folks are hauling it. Half of that, and somebody else is hauling it half of that. In other words, the power is on split between the two of you, the two companies. Cost-wise, is Union Pacific going to be the same cost, and time-wise, over the same sets of tracks? In other words, if you've got it 50% of the time because of the track sharing that are exclusively UP track, and the other folks, SP or whomever, have it 50% of the time of the 400-mile trip. Time to get it from point A to point B and cost to get it from point A to point B. You'd assume, all things being equal, that it would take the same number of days on one track as it takes on the other, and you'd assume that the cost would be relatively the same. Is that assumption out of line?
Well, that is that's a big question. In Oregon, there are few and maybe not many at all long haul interchanges where we would interchange for a significant distance with another railroad who would then carry on for a significant distance. In Oregon, we are hauling either in or out of the state for a long distance, and then interchanging with a short line that's probably going to run in most instances for a short distance. In some instances, it could be, 100 miles or.
Madam Chair, can I just change this? Let's go ahead and have that 400 mile trip with 100 miles the other folks and 300 miles you. So it's 75%, 25%. Mm-hmm. Again, if it takes 3 days for the 300 miles, does it take 1 day for the 100 miles? If it takes $50,000 to move these cars over here, will it take one-third of that $50,000 to move it the rest of the way? That's the question I'm after, yeah. not necessarily the long haul, short haul.
And there's not a uniform answer to that question. Every raw material and every interchange agreement is going to be different. The distance from point A to point B for different goods, the time is going to be different depending on how many carloads are together coming from one customer and going to a destination, and how often a short line, for example, may operate out to a specific customer. And so it's a very difficult question to get your hands around, because every route, every movement of every car is different. I can tell you that on the whole, on moving goods long haul, we are competitive, if not less than in most situations than the trucking industry. The trucking industry plays a vital role in Oregon and nationwide, but oftentimes we're able to move those goods very competitively, if not at a lower rate than the trucking industry, for example. But unfortunately, Representative, it's difficult to answer your question because every movement is different.
Madam Chair, I'll follow up privately. I do have concerns both with regard to the exact arrangement that I'm talking about, the Boardman coal haul, and my agricultural products. As you probably are aware, Chris, most of the agricultural products out of the Treasure Valley have all opted away, with the exception of some of the Cryovac, away from Union Pacific because they just don't get the service. And we've actually tracked some of those and then found weeks later that a car of onions is getting hot in Denver, unfortunately. So I would like to visit a little bit more about that, because I am concerned about agricultural products in Oregon, and I am concerned about our ability to move product around using the shared partnership arrangements that you have with other companies. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Representative Burling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, welcome to Oregon, for one, and I come from a sleepy little hamlet over on the other side of the mountains, which happens to be on your shared track, the city of Bend. And, you know, one of the things that I hear a lot from folks over there, particularly in Redmond, which is the terminal for the Prineville Shoreline Railroad that ties in with the Class 1 there, is that they're being told that the Class 1s, and I'm guessing this is both rails, prefer not to stop anymore to drop off or pick up cars. They like to get these unit trains and just get them up to speed and take off. So, you know, we're sitting here. Last session, we passed Connect Oregon for $100 million, most of which, and very much to the credit of the gentleman from Burlington Northern Santa Fe in 2005, he testified the best thing we could do with that money is help the short lines upgrade so they can carry the heavier cars, and also fix the at-grade railroad crossings, because both of those are freight issues. But we're going to be, again, in this assembly, having the same debate over Connect Oregon 2, and I guess now I'm kind of thinking to myself, well, I haven't seen much change on the ground in my district or in Central Oregon as a whole. I mean, in my the city of Bend, where I come from, we've got 11 at-grade railroad crossings. The city of Redmond to our north has got, I think, 14 or 15. We're actually in the process right now, and I believe representatives from the railroads are working with us on this, to actually look at relocating the rail completely outside of both cities. I think it would be in both parties' best interest. But I'm sitting there thinking, how do you come to the party here? I look at these figures, and we're looking at another $100 or $150 million in investment in infrastructure. And I guess I'd like to, you know, I'm asking you, how do we work together? How do we partner on this stuff to fix some of these problems and get them fixed soon? Because we're experiencing tremendous growth over there, and we got to get this problem resolved. Would you comment on that? And I'm particularly interested in this notion about the cars, the trains just going right through Central Oregon and not stopping. That's a huge problem for us over there as we're growing.
First of all, let me applaud the state of Oregon, the legislature, Governor Kulongoski, for Connect Oregon. What a terrific program. As I travel elsewhere across the West in other states, I tell other states, other state legislators about the program, and really shower praise your way for the vision on that legislation. And I echo, you mentioned the BNSF testimony 2 years ago. I absolutely echo that. I think it's a very wise, prudent investment in the future for dollars that are being dedicated towards freight rail, for those to be invested in the short lines. I think that makes sense. I think that helps Oregon communities. I think that helps those short lines to be able to continue and move those goods regionally and bring those goods to the Class 1 carriers. And that's good for Oregon business. And there's no question that moving goods by unit train is economical. It's efficient. And so that's a plus for a Class 1 railroad. But I can tell you that the Union Pacific is very proud of our manifest business. Some of our manifest business is in unit trains, but our manifest business where we move lumber, for example, where we're picking up cars a few at a time, from some customers, one or two at a time, some might be 10 or 15 at a time. That's a business that we are very proud of. As I pointed out in one of my slides, 21% of our business is in the industrial products group. I think, was it 16% of our business, 14% of our business or so, was in the chemical group, which is another business that is really driven by manifest business, not unit trains. And just last week, we had our leadership conference in Omaha where we talked about the vision for the year, and one of the panels as part of our discussion were key players in that manifest business, and they were a focal point of the discussion because, again, while unit trains are efficient, economical, our network lends itself, and with our network of short line partners, lends itself to the manifest business. And so while we may and are working with customers to try to find ways to be more efficient with their business, we're going to continue to serve and serve ourselves and serve through our short line partners those smaller customers who have the onesies, twosies, 10, 12, 15 cars at a time. But as you all know from your experience here in the legislature, for a business to remain in business, for it to continue functioning, we do have to charge a rate that is reinvestable. That means from every customer, we have to charge a rate that a portion of which goes back into the railroad, goes back into the dollars we're talking about here that we're investing in our railroad to make sure we're running a safe and efficient rail network. And in order to do that, for some customers, that can mean that the rail business doesn't make sense for them. That's a reality that some of our customers and us as a provider of a service have had to face. And those aren't easy decisions. And we try to work with customers. I've been involved in a few of those issues where we try to work with customers to develop alternatives that make sense for that business and make sense for the railroad. And sometimes we can change the dynamic of how we serve a customer to be able to preserve rail service for that customer. Sometimes that's not possible. But most importantly is we need to have a line of communication with the customer, to be upfront and honest, try to work together towards a solution that makes sense for them and for us. We need to be upfront with policymakers like yourselves for when these issues come up, that we can let you know what the facts of the situation are, what we're doing to try to remedy the situation, and then at the end of the day, what the ultimate solution is and why, so that you can know that, and whether it's something that you agree with or not. Hopefully, we've treated the customer and any public policymakers who become involved in an issue like that. We treated you fairly, up front, and honestly.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Chris, welcome to Oregon. I'll never want to come back again after these questions.
I've had worse. This is mild.
We do appreciate UP and the work they do for the state of Oregon. As everyone shares their geographical proximity to you, I just want to share with you, I represent Northeast Oregon. And the Boardman Coal Fire Plant that Representative Butler was talking about is in my district. Hinkle literally is in my backyard, 45 miles away from my home. And about 150 miles of your track goes right through my district. And you're a significant employer in our area, and we appreciate that. You provide good family wage jobs. You provide good benefits. And we want to say thank you for that. At the same time, I would hope you folks would continue as you go through your labor negotiations to remember that it's your employees that make UP. And right now, the folks I'm hearing from back in my district, and I have hundreds of them that work for you and your company, they're concerned about the labor negotiations that are going on, and they feel like they're not getting a fair shake. And so if I could leave a message with you, it would be please understand that these are hardworking folks who care about UP. They care about moving products safely and efficiently through the United States, and I'd hope you'd work with them in good faith. Another issue I want to share with you is I have two major, by the state of Oregon standards, ports, of which rail car availability is a significant issue, especially for processors. And you mentioned in a previous comment about trying to match up the rate to make sure it's efficient and cost effective. I'm not sure a lot of the folks in my area are so much concerned about the rate of a rail car, but it's just the availability of the car and making sure that it's getting picked up on time, especially reefer cars. These small mom and pop food processors, which are major industry in our area, who perhaps are sending out one or two cars a week, they just can't afford to have a frozen food sitting on their tracks for two, three weeks waiting for UP to come and pick up. And so I would hope you could take the message back that we support you, we want to work with you, but we need you folks to also realize we're dependent on you. We really are. And whether it's partnering with our short lines or working with your local labor here in the state of Oregon or trying to make sure that rail cars are available and picked up in a timely manner, we hope you'd step up and do that, and I hope at the same time you'd let us know how we can help you to make that happen. So I know those are a little bit of a hard critique. We do appreciate you, though, being in the state of Oregon. So.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, when I drive up the gorge, there's a track on the north side, and there's a track on the south side, owned by different companies. But I look at it, and because that's one of the choke points, has there been any consideration that the south side would all be eastbound trains and the north side be all westbound trains?
It's good to see you again, Representative. Has there been any consideration? I certainly think that that people have talked about that, and I suspect that people within Union Pacific and Burlington Northern Santa Fe have talked amongst themselves about that. I'm not sure if there's ever been any conversation between the two about that. We are competitive. Very competitive, that route up and down the gorge is something that both sides, both railroads, are very protective of. And I am certainly not someone who could suggest that an arrangement like that will ever happen or will never happen. But it certainly is a very interesting concept, and maybe someday we'll see that. I really can't say anything further on that issue, but you raise a valid issue.
I have one question, and in your improvements and investments in Oregon, is there any plan to raise the tunnel heights so that we can start double stacking more?
That's a good question. I am aware that Union Pacific has evaluated the need for to raise the height on the tunnels in the I-5 corridor. At this time, because of the traffic flows, it is not a high priority project for us. Certainly, as the goods moving in and out of the PNW ports, Portland, Tacoma, Seattle, as that grows, as the number of containers flowing into Oregon and Washington increases, you can see over time pressure building and the need becoming greater to raise the heights of those tunnels. It's not something that is a short-term issue for us, but it's been out there for a long time. It's something that is on our minds. I wouldn't be surprised that it happens someday, but I'm not aware that it's in any short-term capital plans. And our capital investment is driven by demand. As we see projects that are necessary to address bottlenecks, we move to address those issues. And so if we believe that for purposes of efficiently moving freight, safely moving freight, that heightening those tunnels needs to be done in the short term, we'll move that project up in the priority list. Today, because of the flows, because of the flow of traffic, it's not a short-term priority, but it's something that's out there. And if the goods moving into Portland, Tacoma, Seattle necessitate a shift in priorities, we'll do that.
Thank you.
I might add to that, Chris, that we have done some of the...
You need to come forward and identify yourself for us. Thank you.
I'm Jim May with Union Pacific, and we have done...
Up to a microphone. one of these here. They'll share with you. Sorry.
I was just going to say that we have done some of the tunnels as we needed to do work in them. We go ahead and clear them. And like we've had a couple instances where some were caught on fire, so we took, while we were in there, we went ahead and cleared them. And as we inspect tunnels and we find some that, you know, we better do some work on it now or it's going to start caving, we'll go ahead and clear it. So we're not just waiting until, you know, the capital dollars do come to us. But so over time, they're eventually going to get done if we don't move, you know, if we don't move the process up. So.
Thank you.
But it's okay.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Carswell, you want to go ahead?
Thank you. Chair Beyer and members of the committee, appreciate the chance to come here again. My name is Bruce Carswell. I'm the Vice President of the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association, also the President of the Portland and Western Railroad. My presentation today is essentially to try to give an overview of the Oregon Short Line system and some of the issues that face us, specifically from an infrastructure standpoint. Some of this, these issues that I'll raise have been discussed before, in fact, during the last deliberations on the First Connect Oregon program, but I think they're still valid today, and so it would be good to highlight them. And first off, and I've passed out some handouts there. I don't have the PowerPoint presentation, but you can refer to the handouts. First question is, what is a shoreline railroad? And while there's a bit of debate depending on which legislative or regulatory body you're talking about, in rough terms, a class one is a large railroad with more than $250,000 in revenue. Most class ones have much more than that, and short lines are obviously smaller, down below 40 million in many cases, and then regional railroads, which would refer more or less to our system, the Portland Western, fall basically in between. Oregon, as you guys would all know, or you gentlemen and ladies would all know, that there are two class ones, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, are now known as the BNSF, the Union Pacific, and then a fair number of short line and regionals. 21 to be exact, under last counting, and that's been changing. In fact, I suspect that number may be a little bit out of date, given there's been some recent activity even just in the last year. Short lines in Oregon are extremely important. At this point in time, they operate and maintain about 54% of the state's main line. We characterize main line, and that includes branches as well, rail network system. 60% of the state's rail shippers are located on a short line railroad network, and we're currently up, as of 2005 or 6 numbers, about 200,000 carloads a year. So it's a fairly significant number of carloads that are being generated off of these, or being either received or generated off the short line network. Short lines have definitely been a growth segment of the rail business in Oregon, as well as it has been around the rest of the country, and I've got some graphics later on in my handout there that kind of demonstrate that. And nationally, the regional and short line railroads have doubled, more than doubled, since the Staggers Act of 1980 that deregulated the rail system and made the short line movement much more viable than it was previously under the older rules and regulations. The key thing about the short line growth business is that before deregulation, most of the railroads that have been, in recent years spun off would have not been spun off, and it actually would have been abandoned. And we see that all over the state of Oregon. Lines that really weren't economically viable for the larger railroads are now not only being maintained, but in many cases are becoming, a growth engine for the regional economies that they travel through. In the handout, there's a couple of maps or several maps that kind of show the class or the short line and class one rail network and how it plays out in the western part of the state. Without much surprise, that's where the predominance of both the number of railroads and also the number of carloads generated. We range from our system of the Portland and Western at about 100,000 carloads a year, over 470 miles of track, to the Peninsula Terminal in North Portland, which was an old railroad created in 1916 to service the old Union Stockyards, and it only has 2 miles of track. So we go the whole gamut in this part of the state. The eastern part of the state still has a number of short line railroads, although I'd say the density of traffic is a bit sparser, and that obviously creates its own challenges. Talk about the economic impact and benefits of the short line network. Half of the lumber, wood, and paper products shipped out of Oregon utilize rail, and as I said, short lines have over 50% of the trackage, so there's a large portion of that very big economic driver that's coming out of the short line network. Definitely, as highlighted earlier, I mean, there's a you know, a large employment base from the rail employees living in Oregon, and obviously rail employees for the most part have what are characterized as family wage jobs or good paying jobs. As the members of the committee would likely be aware, that you know, moving cargo by rail is in fact much more efficient than moving cargo by truck. And obviously, as we find congestion becoming more and more of an issue on the highways, those alternatives become, you know, very important. The Oregon Railroad miles over the last essentially 20 years, the overall network has diminished slightly from 2,700 miles in the mid 1980s to about 2,400 miles today. But at the same time, the split of mileage between short lines and class ones has gone from 8% of the network to the 54% I described earlier. So, you know, a significant shift as class ones spun off the unprofitable or lower profitability lines, and the short lines have picked those up and tried to make them viable. And then and the next graphic I have in the handout talks about carloads. From 1993's level of 45,000 carloads roughly to 2005's 207,000 carloads. Some of that is because of the divestiture of the network by the Class 1s, but a large portion of it is organic, as we describe growth on those segments. And just to give a little bit of a case study on how that works. Our rail line along the Columbia River in Columbia and Clatsop County, the Astoria line, as it's called, we have doubled the traffic on that rail line since we took it over in 1997. And with the investment in the ethanol plant at Port Westward, that traffic is likely to double again in the next couple of years. So those line segments that were once more or less given up for dead are now out there providing an incredibly important value to the regional economies. It's not all wine and roses. The short line network is got some real challenges. By the very nature of the fact that many of these line segments were essentially divested, the years preceding divestiture usually meant that there was probably not as many maintenance dollars going into those rail lines as you would otherwise like to see. So we've inherited, in many cases, a large deferred maintenance situation. And at the same time, those rail lines also were not upgraded to meet what was, is an ever-increasing standard with regards to gross vehicle weight, the so-called 286 issue, which I'll go into a little bit more detail and has been discussed quite frequently. So that, along with the fact that the increase in vehicle traffic is challenging us at grade crossings, railroad bridges, they're bridges that were built in the 1910s and 1920s are now reaching the end of their useful life, and some of those, especially in this part of the state, are quite sizable, and the timber and wood pilings that they were built out of in the 20s, you couldn't build a bridge like that today because the lumber just is not available in the sizes and in the cost effectiveness needed to do that. So, today, to replace a big timber structure that we see out in the Coast Range and many of the systems there, the only way to replace those bridges in this day and age is steel and concrete, which is obviously fairly expensive. The other issue that faces the short lines is the same one that faces the Union Pacific and the BNSF, and that is capacity. And in many cases, the traffic that we're handling on some of these key short line segments is much greater than it was ever really designed to handle. And we're reaching in some areas practical limits and have our own bottlenecks. Some of them are nowhere near as critical as say the so-called Portland Triangle and those large terminal areas. But even small congestion issues on small branch lines supporting regional and rural economies can be pretty problematic for the customers that rely on those services. The 286 problem, as I described earlier, has been an issue for a number of years for the short lines. Oregon had you know this problem very definitely in the fact that there was a lot of the branch lines that were laid with rail that was less than 110 pounds per yard. That 110 pound per yard standard is really what the industry recognizes as a minimum standard to handle the current industry standard gross vehicle weight of 286,000 pounds. And about 70% of the current short line network is accepting 286,000 pound shipments. That means by default that 30% are not, and of course the customers that are in that 30% are at a significant disadvantage with the rest of the competitive environment. There is 21% of the rail network out there that doesn't have the minimum 110 pounds per yard rail weight, and the cost to upgrade rail line to put new rail in is fairly expensive. Nowadays, with the current steel prices, it'll be pushing beyond the $300,000 per mile price that I have listed in my presentation there. And the problem with 286 is it doesn't affect just the rail. It also becomes a bridge issue as well, much like some of the issues that were raised during the OTIA program. And we have the same sorts of issues. As vehicle weights increase, the bridges eventually feel the pressure. The short line industry's priorities have been fairly consistent and fairly simple for a number of years, and that's to ensure that there are public-private partnership opportunities like Connect Oregon that we can continue to access and work with communities, decide where those critical investments need to be made so that we can continue to be a vibrant part of the regional economy. We also have, some significant issues because of our smaller size. We have real issues with rail safety specifically at grade crossings and with trespassers, and also now the burgeoning security issue. We don't have necessarily the resources at the larger railroads to deal with those significant looming issues. And so there's, to the extent that programs and that sort of thing can be established to help the smaller railroads with that, it's definitely going to be, a valuable improvement for the industry overall. And I'd say, and this is a bit of an editorial statement, but the last thing that we find that is a real challenge, especially for these lower density line segments that comprise short line rail networks, is as we experience explosive growth, especially in the West Coast and in Oregon here, the compatibility of land use issues becomes a real problem for us. The comment that I would make is that there's a generation of land use planners out there that have forgotten that rail lines are in fact an industrial corridor, and high density development along those corridors inevitably leads to conflicts and friction. And there's a finite amount of land along rail corridors, and to the extent possible, that should be maintained and preserved for industries that need access to rail to be economically viable. And I'd say that with that, I'd take any questions.
Thank you, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carswell, thank you for your information. When you look at the number of rail miles that need some care, a high end of $150 million and hundreds of railroad bridges, it seems kind of overwhelming. Have the short line railroads developed anything resembling a list of priorities of as you work with Connect Oregon and other type of possible programs? Is there a list of priorities of how you would go about addressing such a large scale project?
Well, I mean, each individual railroad obviously has done what they can with their own in-house forces, which sometimes are a little bit meager, to try to get the arms around the beast as you describe it. I would say that the larger railroads the Portland and Western and even the Central Oregon and Pacific probably have pretty good start on those comprehensive plans. The smaller railroads are probably a little bit down the curve. I do know that that the rail section of ODOT under Kelly Taylor has a budget item, line item, to put together a comprehensive rail study, which would come up with a more comprehensive and probably better scoped list of these sorts of challenges. And definitely, as a short line industry, we would welcome that, because unfortunately not all of the railroads that are out there have the resources to go out and generate a list of, okay, if I've got, you know, five bridges that are this long and this high, what do we think in this day and age is going to take to replace them, and how long do we have until they're going to essentially need that replacement? So, you know, I'd say that similar to what the state of Washington did with their recent rail study, that sort of a study would be very, very timely in trying to get our arms around this issue, so that not just in future funding programs, but any strategic decisions that industry itself would make, we'd understand where those priorities are.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A little slow on the uptake here. I just would remind you both gentlemen that when you do come asking for funding, that we'll be looking for performance measurements. We're wanting to know how this is going to help the people in Oregon, not just the jobs to make the improvements in the rail lines or whatever, but how it's going to be helping commerce in Oregon and the citizens of Oregon.
Representative Tomei, I understand. I heard those comments in an earlier testimony, and I think we're definitely going to make sure that's you know, brought forward and defined and then ultimately measured.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Hutchinson.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, Vice Chairs Gilman and Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Jonathan Hutchinson. I'm Amtrak's Government Affairs Director for the West. Before moving to California, I lived in Oregon for 13 years, so this is a chance to come back home. So thank you for the opportunity. What I would like to do is to provide the community an overview of Amtrak's service in Oregon, along with summarizing its successes and challenges as they relate to all Amtrak trains serving the state, but ultimately those that Oregon funds. In general, my comments will follow along on the memo that's on the left-hand side of your folder. Let me begin with a few words about Amtrak's background. The National Railroad Passenger Corporation, as Amtrak is formally known, was created in 1970 by the federal government to provide intercity rail service that had been provided by the private freight railroads, but who could no longer afford to sustain it financially. Essentially, Amtrak operates two types of trains. The first type is corridor service that runs between major city pairs roughly 500 miles apart or less, multiple frequencies during the day. The second type of train is long-distance overnight service. Oregon is served by both types of trains. Corridor service in Oregon is provided by a fleet of trains branded Amtrak Cascades that operate between Eugene and Vancouver, British Columbia. Long-distance service in Oregon consists of the Seattle to Portland Empire Builder by way of Chicago, Minneapolis, as well as a long-distance Coast Starlight from Seattle to Los Angeles. The bulk of today's comments will pertain to Amtrak Cascades. Since 1992, Oregon has partnered with Amtrak financially to deliver passenger service in the Portland to Eugene corridor. This 142-mile section is part of the larger 466-mile corridor extending from Vancouver to Eugene. Through the efforts of the states of Oregon, Washington, the host railroads, which are the Union Pacific and the BNSF Railway, Sound Transit, and Amtrak, this corridor has become Amtrak's seventh most heavily utilized corridor nationwide. In 2006, corridor-wide ridership exceeded 627,000 passengers, and within the Oregon segment, state-supported ridership in 2006 exceeded 137,000 passengers, which was an increase of 5.8% versus 2005, and an impressive 66.7% increase versus a decade ago. The presence of intercity rail in Oregon has a number of benefits. First, it augments the state's transportation options. Additionally, it helps preserve Oregon's investment in highway infrastructure, as 61% of Amtrak Cascade's passengers would have driven if the train hadn't been available. Intercity rail also helps the state's travel and tourism industry, as 49% of all Amtrak Cascade's passengers are traveling on vacation. Additionally, the presence of active rail stations in places like Eugene, Albany, Salem, and Oregon City helps stimulate local development in the station area and serve as focal points for the development of intermodal facilities within those regions. Finally, similar to Oregon's other providers of transportation services, Amtrak's 114 employees contributed to the state economically, and Amtrak itself paid over $6.6 million in wages to those employees and spent over $4 million in goods and services in 2006. Despite this, intercity rail has its challenges in Oregon. And these challenges ultimately impact the mode's ability to attract riders, improve its financial performance, as well as its overall utility. Chief among these is reliability. In 2006, only 48% of Amtrak Cascades were on time. Not only are these delays frustrating to passengers, but chronic tardiness negatively impacts the mode's image, suppresses ridership, and inflates operating costs. The majority of these delays within Oregon, 88.4% specifically, are attributable to Amtrak trains having a hard time getting over our host railroad. Now, to be fair, as we've heard from my colleague from the Union Pacific, a lot of the Union Pacific's lines are capacity constrained, and we suffer from that situation. Passengers are often forced to pull over to the side to let freight trains by, or we have to slow down because there's a section of track that has a speed restriction on it. So essentially, the growth in freight is a wonderful thing, but it can negatively impact the fluidity of the rail network, and Amtrak is a part of that. In fairness, the situation is not unique to Oregon. In fact, many of our services outside of the largely Amtrak-owned Northeast Corridor do suffer host railroad caused delays. However, the characteristics of corridor service that make it viable in a segment like the Eugene to Portland corridor are really three things essentially. The first is frequency, the second is thoughtful reductions in travel time, and the third is punctuality. These are very reasonable outcomes and do not require anything radical like new alignments or employing new technologies. Rather, enabling intercity rail to achieve these markers commonly associated with efficacy, such as increasing ridership, revenue, frequently reliable schedules that offer really accessible quality of life and environmental benefits, require commitment. Sustained commitment in investing in both operations and capital. The state that has best demonstrated this kind of commitment toward intercity rail is California, where after $1.8 billion of capital investment, California is now home to Amtrak's second, third, and fifth most heavily utilized corridors nationwide. In fact, 20% of all Amtrak riders system-wide actually ride on California's state-supported corridors. I mention this because California's success began modestly. There were some corridors in California that, like Oregon, had two corridor round trips a day. Then the state invested some money. They were able to add a third round trip. They invested some more money. They reduced the travel times somewhat, perhaps added a fourth trip, etc. And, of course, this success is taking place in a state that was known and is still known as the car capital of the country. In addition to benefiting passenger trains, investing in host railroad infrastructure also helps the freight trains because the investments in tracks, signals, bridges, etc. increase the fluidity of the overall network. The old saying is true, a rising tide lifts all boats, or in this case, an improved rail line benefits all users. Equally significant is that investments in rail infrastructure last a generation. Amtrak is certainly sensitive to the myriad of demands facing the state of Oregon fiscally. However, if intercity rail is to become a meaningful part of an overall management strategy within the Portland to Eugene corridor, or if the state wants intercity rail service to parts of the state currently unserved by Amtrak, like Eastern Oregon, for instance, there has got to be a level of commitment toward the mode. I respectfully submit that in the realm of intercity rail, one gets what one pays for. So far, my comments have focused on the importance of capital funding for rail. And I've done that because of the two types of money intercity rail requires, capital dollars and operating dollars. The capital dollars are generally harder to amass. But as my freight railroad colleagues can attest, rail is a capital-intensive industry, but that does not diminish the importance of finding a stable source of operating funds for these trains. ODOT has proposed a strategy where one of the two Amtrak Cascades round trips between Portland and Eugene would be funded via a method other than the general fund. I think that's an intriguing idea because it has the potential to frame future discussions regarding intercity rail on issues of growth as opposed to preservation. Finally, I would like this committee to understand that as Washington State continues investing in their passenger rail program, there may come a time when Oregon will lose access to one of the two Talgo train sets currently operating between Portland to Eugene. The majority of the Talgo train sets used in Amtrak Cascade service are owned by Washington State, and the need to increase service in the key Portland to Seattle spine with the same amount of equipment may require changes in how that equipment is managed. Hopefully, the future will find intercity rail benefiting from a federal capital matching program, which would greatly ease the threshold states like Oregon and others have to meet to buy new equipment, to invest in track signals, etc., because they're being an active federal partner. But that notwithstanding, I do want the committee to know that there may come a point where even maintaining the status quo in terms of level of service will have a capital cost associated with it. So with that, I'd like to end my formal remarks. I hope I have articulated the importance that sustained investment in intercity rail has in, one, making the existing trains more attractive, two, providing a foundation for new and expanded services, and three, helping our freight railroad partners. With that, I appreciate your time and thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. Mr.
Hutchison.
Thank you. My constituents are very interested in, as am I, in Amtrak. And I know that we've lost so much federal support in the past years. And so it's obvious that we need more support from the state. My constituents are especially interested because of the problem flying nowadays with the lines, et cetera, and all that one has to go through, especially to Seattle and Vancouver, B.C. You didn't talk a lot about that line, but certainly that is one that interests. And as what I understand, even when you can take a train to Seattle, you have to stay all night in Seattle in order to take the train the next day to Vancouver. I would hope that at some point that that could be rectified. And I think it would be good for this committee to hear from you exactly what kind of investment you would need in order for, number one, the trains to be on time, and two, to have a more direct connection to Vancouver, B.C.
Well, I can tell you, Representative Tomei, that the issue with service north of Seattle has been that the province of British Columbia has not historically invested any money in capital to support expanded service. That said, there is a project called the Colebrook Siding, which is just south of the Oregon-British Columbia border, that has to be lengthened to accommodate another round trip. So it essentially has to have expanded capacity. And because of a four-way agreement involving BNSF Railway, Amtrak, the province of British Columbia, and Washington State, that Colebrook Siding extension is likely to be funded, which means that by the 2010 Olympics, there will be a second daily round trip between Seattle, north to Vancouver, British Columbia. And that second train would be significant because the timing is such that it would, for the first time, allow same-day single-seat service from points south of Seattle to Vancouver, British Columbia. Now, service beyond that second round trip is going to require a significant capital investment in both tracks, signal improvements, and additional rolling stock. Related to your second question, the state of Oregon does have a plan that was last updated in April of 2000 that calls for five round trips a day between Portland and Eugene with a running time of about 1 hour and 50 minutes. And that plan has identified some broad types of improvements that would have to be necessary to support that level of service. Now, to drill down to more specific kinds of investments would require modeling the corridor with Union Pacific's assistance to really understand in this day and age with the current kinds of traffic flows, train velocities, et cetera, what kinds of improvements would support what kind of expanded passenger service. But certainly, that is something that Amtrak has helped with in the past and could help with in the future if there was the sense that there would be the capital dollars to actually make that happen. But we could absolutely understand what needs to happen for all the passenger trains to operate more reliably and more frequently throughout the corridor.
Follow up?
Yes.
Ed? A special interest to me is the trains being on time. So we don't need to answer that today, but I would really be interested sometime if you could give me information on what would help the trains to be on time.
Certainly.
So thank you so much.
Thank you. Representative Buckland.
I'm also very curious. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Tomei's questions about what's staying in the way or what will it take for us to actually get that project undertaken to get the trains to run as the vision has been expressed. So is this an okay time to ask? Do you have a short answer to that? What would it take?
The short answer, Representative Buckley, is at the end of the day, what intercity rail needs to run more frequently and more reliably is sustained capital investment. So that, for instance, the tracks that we share, south of Portland with the Union Pacific, north of Portland with the BNSF Railway, can accommodate growing freight traffic, growing passenger traffic, and can do so easily so that trains don't get delayed waiting for meets between two trains, or that sidings are long enough to accommodate longer and heavier freight trains. So the challenges that we have throughout the country, really, fundamentally deal with or stem from the fact that more and more work is being asked of these rail lines that are increasingly capacity constrained. And what needs to happen is there has to be investment required to support a higher level of service as defined by either more frequencies, service to other parts of a state, and also enhanced reliability. If you looked at the map of the Union Pacific where some of the double track sections are within their network, some of those segments of double track, for instance, existed or were installed because of additional passenger service. So the state of California, for instance, paid in excess of $66 million to double track most of the alignment between Sacramento and Oakland. Now, that investment not only helped and helps Amtrak, but it also helped Union Pacific, because what was a single track on it with some double tracks has now become entirely double tracked. So it's an investment in the network to increase the overall fluidity and efficiency of the network. So that's the simple answer to your question.
That's an excellent answer. Thank you. I'd like to get a price tag at some point for Eugene to Portland. If I can follow up with one more. You intrigued me with your comment about ODOT having a proposal for a different funding source. Is that something that you could tell us about now, or do you want the ODOT to
Well, I believe Kelly Taylor is here, and she really is the expert on this. So if you'd like, we could address the question to her, because it's an ODOT proposal.
All right, thank you.
Yes, Kelly, back there, do you want to come up and talk?
If this is a surprise, you want to wait till Easter or something. I don't know. But
Madam Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kelly Taylor, ODOT Rail Division. The bill is Senate Bill 225. It actually aligns with something the legislature did back in 2003. It would change currently custom license plates when I have my name on my plate, not ABC123, but I choose to put Kelly on my plate.
Right.
Because I choose to do so, the fee that I pay, the $50 every 2 years to have Kelly on my plate, is not dedicated to the highway fund, because I'm not required to have Kelly on my plate. I choose to do so. Currently, that money goes to what's known, commonly referred to as the Teen Litter Program. We've proposed in Senate Bill 225 to change that so that the fees from customized license plate, which generate about $4.3 million, would go towards passenger rail. That would pay for almost one of the two trains. And instead, we'll still have the Teen Litter Program, but we would pay for it out of highway funds. That is an eligible use of highway funds because you're doing highway maintenance. It's something that the governor's office put in their budget. It's something my commission looked at. I mean, we're a multimodal agency, and so we need to balance the funds against all the different modes. You all asked last time in the 05 session if we couldn't come forth with a funding option to try to move the trains off general fund. I would like to do that very much. I know general fund dollars are needed for some pretty important programs. And if I can move the trains to something that's more steady and more reliable, then we won't have the concern every other session with having to cut the trains.
Very
so
good.
It's a step forward. That's what's in Senate Bill 225.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Seeing no other questions here, thank you, gentlemen. Our next panel will be Sam Ruta with the Port of Portland, Ray Barbie with Roseburg Forest Products, and Monica Ishbel with Schnitzer Steel. So whoever gets down and situated first will get to start. We have a winner. Go ahead and introduce yourself. And
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sam Ruta, and I currently serve as the Marine and Industrial Development Director at the Port of Portland. I report to Bill Wyatt, the Port's Executive Director. The Port of Portland's main marine facilities are located at or near the confluence of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers. We continue to have a diversified portfolio of marine activity, ranging from containers, grain, finished automobiles, mineral bulk commodities, and steel. In calendar year 2006, the port had 793 ship calls, a 16% gain over 2005. We also had a record year for auto imports, reaching 463,000 units. In total, the port moved 12 million tons of cargo over its four primary marine facilities. The economic contribution of the marine division of the port produces close to 12,000 jobs and approximately $900 million in annual personal income. This data is taken directly from our 2006 economic impact study. Given the scope and scale of the port's operations, it cannot be stressed enough that the viability of Portland as a gateway port in the Pacific Northwest is tightly coupled with that of the Class I railroads. This is not to minimize the importance of the short lines in both the state and the region. Rather, it simply underscores that the Port of Portland's customers and business lines are highly dependent on access to the mainline capacity of the Union Pacific and Burlington Northern Track. These customers are businesses with a base of operations in the state that require rail service in order to compete globally and nationally. In many respects, Portland has had the historic good fortune of being located at a geographic nexus of significant railroad infrastructure. At Portland, there is access to the mainline capacity of both Class I railroads. From Portland, one can move east utilizing the BNSF track on the north side of the Columbia River, and also the Union Pacific's track on the Oregon side. Additionally, there is also the north-south axis of the two railroads available at or near the Port of Portland. This nexus of vital railroad infrastructure comes together in a network of mainline track, switching yards, siding track, all located in what is commonly referred to as the Portland Triangle. While this historic good fortune has served Portland well, it is not necessarily a given that the good times will automatically last forever. Indeed, the railroad industry is still evolving. In the period since deregulation, we have seen mergers and acquisitions reduce the number of West Coast Class I railroads down to two. As such, the two remaining Class I railroads, who today serve Portland, our state, and our region, are of critical importance to the future success of Portland as a major port of entry and exit in the Pacific Northwest. As with deregulation that has played itself out in the commercial aviation and trucking industries, the market forces impacting today's Class I railroads deserve close attention. In pure economic terms, the Class I's find themselves today in an operating environment where supply, as demonstrated by track capacity, and market demand, as characterized by market need for railroad service, is very much in the railroad's favor. New business or maintaining existing business is not necessarily the gold standard in terms of railroad objectives. Improving turn time of equipment, often referred to as velocity, and achieving sustained and improved returns on invested capital are the new metrics in the railroad industry. It is in this environment that the port and the state need to work collaboratively with the Class 1s so as to strategically align our investment and rail strategies. In simple terms, we are essentially competing for this mainline capacity. Our customers are competing for this mainline capacity as well. To their credit, the Class 1s are focused on improving yields so as to justify the huge capital investments that they are making to support increased capacity and velocity in their respective networks. I will digress for a moment just to emphasize that in Mr. Peterson's remarks on investment by the Union Pacific, the capital improvements that they've made in the line that connects the Port of Portland to the Canadian CP network, that investment has increased service levels and really was a contributory factor in one of our major port customers, Canpotex, based in Saskatoon, for making significant commitments to the port and infrastructure investments at our Terminal 5 facility. From a port and statewide perspective, we too are competing for where the railroads make their investments. As we look to the future, I can say with certainty that the frequency of trips by myself and my staff to Omaha and Fort Worth will be increasing by the port. We expect to work collaboratively to maintain the Class 1's attention and their long-term support. Our success as a port is increasingly linked to the business decisions that the Class 1's make or do not make. In conclusion, our historic geographic good fortune with respect to sustained access to the Class 1 rail network from Portland should not be taken for granted. Moving forward, we will need to look strategically to develop near and longer-term investment strategies that build the required infrastructure that supports increased capacity and flow in and around the Portland Triangle. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, people. Any questions? No? Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Monica Isbell, and I'm the owner of Starboard Alliance Company, which is a supply chain consulting practice. And I have also worked during my 27-year career in international trade for importers, exporters, and logistics service providers. Part of my work is dedicated to helping companies optimize their supply chains and solve their logistics and transportation problems. I'm speaking to you today on behalf of one of my clients, Schnitzer Steel Industries, as well as rail-dependent shippers around Oregon in general, to help you understand how the rail network influences the international and domestic supply chains of these companies and what maybe can be done to improve the service levels. In the fall of 2005, I was approached by my client to perform a study to really determine whether the rail service issues that they were facing were isolated and unique or whether other rail-dependent shippers in Oregon were facing similar issues. So I basically put together a very detailed questionnaire and also a long list of rail-dependent shippers in the state. I interviewed by phone 21 shippers. And they were located within and beyond the Willamette Valley area. And the goal was to ascertain their supply chain profiles as well as the nature and extent of their interaction with the rail network. The questions were both quantitative and qualitative. These companies ship, receive, or do both via rail. All of them are rail dependent. Most of them were served by only either one Class 1 or one short line. Most have very few other cost-competitive alternatives to rail service. Collectively, these shippers use two of the Class 1 railroads in the state, the BN and the UP, as well as five of the short lines. The number of rail cars moved annually by these companies ranged from a few to 5,500, and that was really shifting because some of these companies were being forced to shift to truck when they could because of deteriorating rail service or availability of cars. The product mix of these shippers is diverse and includes steel, paper products, plastic resin products, grain fertilizers, nursery supplies, lumber products, waste paper, and rubber flooring. The shippers move their products all across Oregon and the U.S. and the world. Let me state that all shippers interviewed see and value the need for effective, efficient rail service. The question at hand today is, how can the state help improve the difficult situation with which these Oregon rail-dependent shippers are confronted? We need reliable and cost-competitive rail service for Oregon shippers to succeed and for Oregon to succeed. I'd like to describe some key study findings, which, may I also point out, are similar to the results that I discovered during my work on the Washington Statewide Rail Capacity and Needs Study last year. The data revealed that all but one shipper experiences service problems with the various Class I and short line railroads, some indicating these issues are severe, long-standing, and persistent. Rail service performance has declined over the past few years, as well as rates have increased at the same time, often dramatically. Service from short lines was rated slightly higher than the Class I's, as most shippers understand that the short lines are dependent upon the Class I's in performing their daily work and are often unable to make service improvements due to the structure, agreements, and service failures of the Class I's. The shippers interviewed mentioned problems in various areas. The most prevalent cited were as follows. Number one, the supply of empty rail cars is insufficient or inconsistent, which makes it difficult for shippers to plan labor requirements for cargo loading and meet customer delivery requirements. The requested quantity of rail cars is not delivered to the shipper's rail spur in the requested time frame per the booking. Often shippers have limited room to store their components, semi-finished products, or finished products at their facilities, or they operate under a just-in-time profile. These shippers depend upon having their empties when they need them to keep the manufacturing or sales process flowing smoothly. Number three, loaded rail cars are not picked up from the rail spur as requested. And this could be by the Class I or the short line. Often shippers have limited yard area or limited sized length of track at their spur, so loaded rail cars may back up, and this impedes their smooth operations. Number four, delays in transit to final destination negatively affect customer satisfaction and can result in canceled orders, forced discounting of prices, and perhaps even lost future sales. Number five, erratic transit times make it difficult for shippers to accurately promise delivery times to their customers. Six, unresponsiveness of the railroads to shippers' requests for problem resolution forces shippers to spend more administrative time tracking and monitoring their shipments and trying to find solutions to their problems. During the surveys, I heard comments such as, the railroad told me, quote, you'll get your rail cars when we give them to you, unquote. I regularly order two rail cars and only get one. Sometimes I get my rail cars 3 days too early or 3 days after when I need them. It takes longer for my rail cars to go from Eugene to Jefferson than from Canada to Jefferson. The distance to destination is only 90 miles, but my shipments are usually delayed 5 to 7 days. I call the railroad to complain, but my pleas for improved service fall on deaf ears. My company is afraid the Class I will shut down my rail spur. The railroads have too much business and are turning away cargo that is not profitable. I'm afraid they will turn away mine. I was surprised and disheartened by the acute frustration that most of these interviewees expressed by their perceived lack of clout with the railroads.
Most feel powerless to change the situation, and they are afraid to complain for fear that could jeopardize further their already substandard service. How are Oregon rail-dependent shippers dealing with rail service issues? Those who are able switch a portion to truck if and when they can find them, but at an increased cost. All spend increased administrative time monitoring and tracking their shipments and proactively communicating with the railroads to solve their problems. Many have increased the amount of inventory they hold to cover rail service delays or added extra days or weeks to their order and manufacture cycle times. All these actions increase operating costs, which negatively impacts the shippers' bottom lines and ability to compete in their markets. The outlook for the future seems dim as well. Nearly all 21 shippers interviewed expect that rail service will worsen in the future or at best remain the same. They don't believe the railroads will invest enough to increase track capacity, buy enough locomotives and rail cars, add enough personnel to meet growing customer demand, and specifically meet their own transportation requirements. Rate relief is not anticipated either. The state of Oregon can play an active role in improving the situation for its rail-dependent shippers. I have 6 recommendations. 1. In the past few years, the Class 1 railroads have modified their business models to reflect their preference to hook and haul unit trains of several hundred cars. They are also increasingly catering to the intermodal market at the expense of the rail car market, carload market. This model greatly impacts many Oregon shippers who move limited quantities of rail cars or on an infrequent basis. Oregon needs a new strategy which recognizes the current rail operating environment. Short lines represent the future of added capacity, but the short lines seem constrained by the terms of arrangements with the Class 1s. They also have little leverage to avoid switch charges when cars are transferred from the Class 1 to the short line. We need a new policy that addresses how and where to invest state dollars to achieve maximum benefit for Oregon shippers and consumers. 2, Connect Oregon and programs like it are important to rail-dependent shippers to maintain and upgrade their rail spurs, as well as to Class 1 and shortline railroads to improve infrastructure and increase capacity so that Oregon shippers will be better served. The state should provide funding to expand and improve the mainline capacity in Oregon, rail sidings and rail yards, and create new grade separations, which will benefit Oregon companies selling internationally and domestically. Funding to Class 1 and shortline railroads should be tied to achieving a certain minimum standard of service performance. 3, as a precursor to a more comprehensive analysis, my client is willing to share with ODOT an executive summary of the confidential study that my company performed. ODOT should then commission a larger study that reaches more rail-dependent shippers across the state. ODOT could use the data to develop a strategy and game plan to help rail-dependent shippers in Oregon remain competitive in their markets. 4, as advocates for Oregon rail-dependent shippers, the governor, legislature, and ODOT should proactively engage the Class 1s and the short lines to encourage them to find solutions to service and infrastructure problems that occur in the state. 5, a state-sponsored committee should be assembled that includes rail-dependent shippers, Class 1, short line representatives, government, and other industry representatives to brainstorm solutions that make sense for Oregon. 6, Oregon should not view itself in a vacuum, but rather understand the role the state plays as a link to the West Coast transportation system and how the rail network interfaces here and is interconnected with the rail system in neighboring states. It should work cooperatively with neighboring states and organizations such as the West Coast Corridor Coalition to develop a sound West Coast strategy to keep freight moving. In closing, let me offer that reliable, affordable, and consistent rail service is essential to many Oregon companies.
Yet if what I have learned with this small study can be confirmed to a larger, on a larger scale, we are facing more serious economic and transportation issues than we may have previously thought. To stay in business and remain competitive, some Oregon businesses, if they can, are switching a portion of their shipments to truck when they can. But this is contrary to some of the investments they've made to move via rail, such as in their own rail spurs, and also contrary to a general desire to see more freight move via rail and off the highway system. But for some companies, trucking is not a viable option and does not make them truly competitive. If they aren't competitive, these businesses may downsize or cease operating altogether. This issue deserves your careful attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it at all possible to get copies for the committee of your testimony?
Yes.
Thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair, if that testimony could be emailed out to us, I would really appreciate that. This is a very valuable testimony, and
yes.
I thought for a time Ms. Isbell was relating issues that were happening in my district instead of hers. So,
thank you. Electronic would be great if you can do that. Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. Thank you. That was depressing as all get out.
I'm very sorry because I was depressed myself.
I can imagine, but I would echo Representative Tomei's request and also the recommendation from the study that that customer satisfaction be part of the benchmarks that we check in terms of what we fund. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Go ahead. A hard act to follow there.
Madam Chair, distinguished committee members, guests, my name is Ray Barbie, and I'm Vice President of Sales and Marketing and Logistics for Roseburg Forest Products. Thank you very much for the opportunity to visit with you today. I'm representing, I think, some of the issues that you'll be hearing about from the customer's perspective. Since we are a large privately held company, I elected not to provide any handouts, but I will provide some statistics and be glad to answer any questions as appropriate. Roseburg Forest Products is a 70-year-old forest products company headquartered here in the state of Oregon. We have 9 manufacturing facilities in the state of Oregon that provide employment to about 2,600 people here in the state. We have 2 others on the West Coast, and we just acquired 7 facilities in the Southeast. So in total, we employ about 3,900 people and operate about 18 manufacturing facilities. My comments relative to shipping of product to market will be restricted to this particular area. As a company, about 68% of the product that we manufacture, 68% of the product that we manufacture ships to the marketplace via rail. The other 32% goes by truck. For perspective, in the state of Oregon, that's about 14,000 outbound rail cars per year and about 32,000 trucks, some of which are customer-owned, some of which we arrange for transportation. We ship to about 650 different customers and about 1,100 different ship-to locations. So logistics is a very important aspect of our business. I would also say that as a company, we continually, year in and year out, invest between $40 and $50 million in capital expenditures in our facilities to maintain those facilities and to keep them cost competitive in order that we can provide product to our customers as cost effectively and efficiently as possible. I'd like to address a couple of different areas that I was asked to as a result of being here today, one of which is an overview of the rail system and service. As I mentioned, and I hope you clearly understood, that rail service is extremely important to not only Roseburg Forest Products, but to anyone who is in the forest products industry. If you think about logs, lumber, plywood, particle board, those are large products, bulk or cube, whatever you want to call it. Most of them are heavy, and truly the most efficient and effective way for us to get that product to the customer is via rail. At times we have to break a rail car down, and when we do, to ship it via truck, it usually takes about three trucks to equate out to what one rail car would. From our perspective, I think the issue that most concerns us about the railroad here in the state of Oregon is the infrastructure. And it's the tracks, it's the tunnels, it's the bridges, and it's the trestles. And I think all of you have heard about the many derailments that we've had, the track failures that we've had, the tunnel closures that we've had down at the Siskiyou, at Coos Bay. Those are greatly concerning to us simply because they interrupt the flow of product to our customers, and they end up costing us money in terms of either offloading to trucks or taking a longer, more circuitous route on the rail system to get product to our customers. It costs us money. Rail system's role in Oregon's economic vitality, it is huge in my estimation. By my recollection, about 34% of the lumber consumed in the U.S., certainly in new home manufacture, new construction, comes from the state of Oregon. And I would venture to say that the predominant amount of that, far and away, gets to the customer, gets to the pro yard, gets to the dealer via rail. Plywood, lumber, engineered wood products, all ship via rail. We do ship some by truck, but our preference is always rail. It is the most economic means of getting product to our customers, and it's the way our customers prefer to receive product, which is also an important aspect of your consideration because they pay the freight. When we lose rail service, it ends up costing us money as a shipper. It'll eventually end up costing the state of Oregon money in terms of curtailments and potential plant closures if we lose rail service. That translates into lost jobs, lost revenue, and loss in our tax base. Issues facing the rail industry and rail customers, again, it's the condition of rail track. And I think one of my colleagues referenced some deferred maintenance from the 70s and 80s, and I think, in fact, our failure to do some of that maintenance that should have been done then and replacing some of the rail that's out there has come back to haunt us, certainly in the last economic cycle that we experienced. I'm very hopeful, and I'm sure many of you are, that we see another cycle representative of 2004, 5, and most of 2006 very soon. But I will be very quick to say that they also took a toll on our highways as we saw more product shipped by truck, and it took a toll on our railroads in terms of a lot of failures out there in terms of derailments and just railroad ties, tunnels, etc. Another major concern for us as a shipper are escalating freight rates. We are seeing escalating freight rates sometimes in double digits. We're getting them from all carriers. I know the railroads need money. We all need money. We all need to earn our cost of capital. That, from my vantage point, is truly the measure of an entity that is viable long-term, is whether you can earn your cost of capital or not. I was visiting with one of the CEOs for Class 1 Railroad within the last 4 months, and I asked him, I said, out of the past 10 years, how many of those years have the railroads earned their cost of capital? And he said, embarrassing, probably no more than three. And that makes it difficult, I think, for them to do some of the maintenance that needs to be done. It's a conundrum. I don't understand it. I don't have the answer to it. We all want higher prices. We want higher rates. But if you get the revenue up, you've got to see it flow to the bottom line. If it doesn't flow to the bottom line, you probably have operating inefficiencies that you aren't addressing. Reliability is a key factor for us as a shipper. My colleague referenced reliability and dependability, having rail cars arrive when you order them on time. We all have issues from time to time with that. There's no two ways about it. Some of those we understand, and what you have to do is you just have to work with your carriers, work with your short line as we do, and with the UP, and stay in front of them in terms of what your demands are and what your needs are. Our chairman and owner, Alan Ford, makes a frequent trip back to Omaha to visit with the UP. We are captive to the UP. We visit with Jim Young, who is chairman of the UP, and he knows who we are. That's part of what you've got to do, in my estimation, to increase the amount of service that you get. You've got to go where you've got to get. The rubber needs to meet the road, I guess I would say it, and that's, we go back there to be sure that happens. For us, there are very few viable alternatives if we can't ship by rail. You can put product on truck, but you can do that only so long. I think the recent incidents we've had with the tunnel outage down at the Siskiyous and also at Coos Bay, I hope all of you understand the impact that had on us as a shipper. Delayed shipments end up costing us money, not only in terms of getting product to customers, but customers today, whether you are aware of it or not, are actually fining their suppliers if you're late on shipments. We stand to get fined by many of the customers that we do business with. This is especially true of the big boxes today. Home Depot, Lowe's, Menards, if you give them an acknowledgement and for some reason or other your product ships late, doesn't arrive in the time frame that it should have to them, you're subject to be fined. I mentioned earning the cost of capital. That's very important. An alarming trend that we are seeing today is an assessment of surcharges by carriers to cover unexpected repair costs. It'd be great if we could do that for all of our customers, but we aren't able to. When we have a problem in our facilities or whatever, we have to deal with that. And the assessments by the railroads are not going down very well for the failures that are occurring in terms of tunnels, tracks, whatever. The last statement that I would make in closing, just to bring home to you the importance of the rail system in Oregon, would be this. In the forest products industry especially, and in our business, getting product to our customers via rail is critical. And one of the impacts that increased rates have had on us is that it's caused our market radius to come in. We can't ship as far as we once could. If we can't get the service we need in Oregon, and if we can't get to our customers via rail, what we'll do is we'll go outside of Oregon and invest somewhere else in facilities. We'll go to where our customers are. We'll do that. It's not our choice, but we're going to grow our business. We want to grow our business. We're committed to it, and we'll continue to make the capital investments that we need in our facilities year in and year out, so that we can provide product to our customers efficiently and cost effectively as we can from a manufacturing standpoint, but we have to be able to deliver the product to our customers. And we want to invest in Oregon and not elsewhere. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel?
Madam Chair?
Yes,
Representative. I think that's supposed to be the only question that comes to mind, Mr. Barber, is Isabel's recommendations of trying to actually perhaps get people in one place, shippers, the rail companies, and the state government in one place to try to address this. Is that an avenue that you would also suggest that we go down?
I certainly think that's an option as long as we have appropriate legal counsel there.
So noted.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate you coming all the way. I'm going to call up one more person, Fred Nussbaum. I don't know how much longer I'm going to be able to hold the committee. I think we're going to have to delay the hearing on the memorial, and I will coordinate with the one person who signed up to explain the issue on when maybe we can hear something about that one again. And go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Fred Nussbaum. I'm a strategic planner for AORTA, the Association for Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates. We represent passengers of passenger rail, intercity bus, and public transit throughout the state of Oregon. I'm going to keep my comments as brief as possible. I know everybody's trying to head home here. I've got a car that's over limit on the meter, too, so just want to explain, I'm a trained transportation planner. I used to work for TriMet years ago. This marks my 30th year working on state-supported passenger rail service in the state, mostly as a citizen, actually only as a citizen, not for any public agencies. We need to do more than just tread water with the passenger rail program. We've had to do that in the last couple of sessions because of the recession that we had, but our economy is doing better, and we need to get back on plan. We are 10 years behind officially adopted plans by the state of Oregon. We should be having 5 round trips per day, according to those plans, 1992 plan and the 2001 update of that plan. We have a very immature service. Right now, it works well for certain trips, but it doesn't work well for others. I cannot get down to Salem to do business here before noon, and to go back in the evening, like today, there's no service that will take me back to Portland after 4:15. So the Oregon Rail Program is a combination of the trains, the 2 round-trip trains that we have, and 2 throughway buses that also operate in the same corridor that stop at each of the stations. There's no reason why we can't add, until we get the infrastructure improvements, that we can't add a few more throughway buses to fill in the schedule. It's a great way of building up ridership, market share, and when those buses get full, then it's time to put a train on. There was a question, I believe, from you, Representative Buckley, about what we need right now to get the trains running reliably. We do have an answer for that. There are 2 projects in Eugene and Albany areas that have been on the books as priority projects for getting reliability up and for providing additional capacity to add the passenger trains to the mix of freight trains. One of those is, well, it was $5.6 million roughly 2 years ago. It's probably gone up a little bit. But that was for a passing track in Eugene and a layover track in Eugene so that the passenger trains could stop at the station and not interfere with the through movement of freights. There's another project in the Albany area for adding centralized traffic train control there. That's automatics or signalization that would help movement of all trains, freight and passengers. That was also somewhere around $5-6 million the last time that was estimated. That's probably gone up a bit too. So we're talking around $12 million if we do it, you know, today. Both of those projects were submitted for Connect Oregon funds. Both of those projects made it 2/3 through or 3/4 of the way through the process and then fell off the list at the very end. And that is a problem for the passenger rail program is that, as Mr. Hutchison said, we need sustained funding. And the Connect Oregon is not really a sustained funding source. It's sort of a one project at a time funding source, and sometimes you're lucky and sometimes you're not. We weren't lucky this last time around. We might be lucky this time around, but we don't know. We won't find out until the end of that process. So perhaps what we need to do is find a capital funding that is more specific to the passenger rail program so we can get back on track, so to speak. Jonathan also mentioned that the rail equipment problem that we have, that since Washington State and Amtrak own all the trains that operate down here, if they decide, which they're very close to doing within the next couple of years, that they want to redeploy that equipment between Portland and Seattle, then we will be missing a train. And the state needs to get involved in that. It takes about 2 years to go through the whole procurement process to get new rail equipment. So if we don't do that this session, we could end up with maybe some old heritage equipment, but it won't be the same thing as those nice sleek Talgos that have been operating in the corridor here. Another thing that kind of bleeds into a different area is that the state really needs to get involved in the whole intercity passenger area. It's sort of a crack in the whole works is that we have the rail program. The state has been looking into that. We haven't put enough money into it as we should. And we have a public transit division that takes care mainly of the elderly and disabled services. But in terms of what's happened out there in the intercity bus area since Greyhound pulled out of service through most of Oregon, there's nothing there to fill that hole. That doesn't mean the state has to get into the actual intercity transportation business as in owning buses and managing all that, but there are a number of things the state can do to help the private operators do the job for us in terms of insurance pool, in terms of helping them do some of the planning and dispatching or something, any number of things. And that hasn't happened really so far. So there's a need to try to integrate that all together and to integrate that intercity service that connects communities off of the passenger rail corridor into the rail system. We have some of that with thruway bus service connecting Astoria, for instance, into Portland and then onto the Amtrak service. We have Bend connected in, but there are many communities throughout the state that don't have service or have very poor service. In other words, the same problem as you have when you're trying to go from Portland to Vancouver, B.C., where you have to stay overnight to do your business because there's only one bus a day going in either direction. So, AORTA stands ready to help the rail division in the planning efforts that people have talked about, updating the rail plan. The last effort was not really a plan, but sort of a reiteration and some number crunching that they did. But it didn't really reiterate the vision that the state would like to have for the passenger rail program. We've been involved in that process since day one, and we would like to be involved in it again. So with that, I'll conclude my comments and take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
I'll ask a quick one.
Okay.
And if you have any ideas on that dedicated funding source, I'm sure you'll throw them out, right?
Oh, you mean on the vanity plate fund?
Yeah. Or any other ideas that you might have that would, you know, bring in the type of millions that we need for these sort of projects?
Well, one idea that has been kicked around is a carbon tax on all forms of not just transportation but industry and so on. In this day and age of having of greater understanding of climate change and so on, it may be time to start thinking about that. So
one of my constituents actually called me on that this morning.
Oh.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, committee. We won't be meeting on Friday this
thank
week,
you, Madam
so
Chair.
We'll see you on Monday of next week.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.